Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Contrary to what many people believe, we can recover from emotional trauma relatively quickly and completely on our own. Whether it's extreme trauma, such as sexual abuse or the horrors of war, or less dramatic, but psychologically speaking, just as serious wounds involving shame and guilt, we don't need to spend years in intensive therapy to recover. While most people know what they can do on their own to treat physical ills, like using ice on a muscle sprain, they don't realize that they can apply certain psychological principles to treat anxiety, depression, and many other conditions in the comfort of their own homes. Today's special guest, Dr. Chris Quartman, co-author with Dr. Joseph Walden of the book Keep Pain in the Past, Getting Over Trauma, Grief, and the Worst That's Ever Happened to You, will teach you the critical 21st century skill of treating your own psychological wound. Dr. Quartman has been a licensed psychologist for 28 years. He is a much sought-after speaker and has facilitated more than 60,000 hours of psychotherapy. And I'm ready to introduce my special guest to you, Dr. Quartman. Good morning and welcome, Dr. Quartman.
Good morning to you. I am very honored to be on the show. The bad news is that I'm over 32 years now and 70,000 hours, so time just keeps on flying by.
Okay. I take it off the pitch that I get, but...
No, I know. I listened to it and said, boy, those were the days. Now I'm past 32 years.
Oh, my gosh.
But thank you so much for inviting me on the show. I appreciate it. I'm excited to talk to you.
So, yeah, I'm excited to talk to you, too. My work is in helping people overcome narcissistic abuse. And so reading your book, I could relate to so many things, but I also was given so many tools to use to help people with this. And I agree with a lot of what you say, and some was just, you know, new information to me. But regardless, I love your book, Keep Pain in the Past.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you and Dr. Walden wrote this book. What prompted that?
I have been working in this field now, as I said, for over 30 years. And it has occurred to me that I am not happy with some of the treatments that are offered for the treatment of for trauma, for instance. And I was at a conference probably 5 years ago and listened to someone say, these are the best two treatments we have for post-traumatic stress. And as I'm listening to the presenter, I said, boy, that is so not true. You just don't know that there are better options than the ones you're presenting today. And I said, well, no one will know about these things unless I put them in a book, because how else will people know about available treatments if someone doesn't share them, and especially in the written word? But that's one of the reasons I'm excited to be invited to a show like yours, because I have information that I feel is really worth sharing. Anytime you've done something for more than 70,000 hours, you have some level of expertise at that particular craft. Malcolm Gladwell talked about 10,000 hours being expert. So I feel like, you know, there's some expertise here, and something that just continually works in the confines of my own practice, but no one sees what happens behind closed doors, hence the need for the book. So I grabbed Dr. Walden, who is a very young man. He's just hit 30, but he was my postdoc resident. He just finished his doctorate, and I asked if he had studied a lot about trauma and worked at the VA, if he wanted to be my co-author, because I wanted to make sure that everything I said also honored what was cutting edge in the field, since it had been a long time since I'd been in school. But he had just emerged from academics. So he was delighted to play co-author and to make sure I was up to date on the research.
Well, that's great. Do you find that you learn everything that you need in school, or does it take years of practice to really hone those skills?
It takes years of practice. I mean, school gives you a nice beginning. It's great to have a doctorate in any field, but I would have been completely ill-prepared if I had not been taught by my patients one at a time what works and what heals and what doesn't work and what doesn't heal. So having the opportunity to work in vivo, in real life, on the job training, if you will, allowed me to hopefully come as close to possible at perfecting a theory that seems to work. And it's one that is very well grounded in everything from Freudian theory to neuroscience and neuropsychology, to the stress response that was written about in the 1920s by Hans Selye at the University of Montreal, to today's cognitive behavioral therapy. All of these things have given me a solid foundation. Even religion, if you take a look at all the religions in the world, with the exception of maybe Satanism, they all begin with, you know, love and the notion of forgiveness, which is really about letting go. And so when we talk about trauma, what heals trauma is not what everyone tells you, which time heals all wounds, is just such a terrible myth, because it teaches people passivity and that this will get better over time. And here I am working with Vietnam veterans who've been home for 51 years, and the trauma didn't get better over time. If anything, they have to go back now and deal with what has never been dealt with before if they want to heal. And so what's better than things get better over time is the realization that we have to finish things actively. Healing is about letting go. So back to the religion, forgiveness equals letting go. Forgiveness doesn't condone bad things. It just lets them go.
I completely, completely agree with you. And it's the same with the people that I work with. And they're always told, why don't you let it go already? And I say if they could, they would have. And this was, you know, I copied down something that you wrote. Well, I copied down a lot that you wrote in the book, but this particular sentence really resonated with me because I find this to be true. You said, without believing a therapist gets what you've been through and that he can help you or she, you won't feel safe or heard and will leave usually sooner rather than later. Most therapists focus on coping rather than healing. As such, therapists don't believe that you really can heal from emotional trauma. I find that the first session that I have with people who are hurting tremendously, they get the biggest release in that session because I get what they've been through. I've been through it. And validating that releases so much of the stress and pain. So what do you have to say about that? I mean, other than what you said.
Well, I'm so glad you used the V word because it all comes down to validation. And the moment that they get that you get them, you have them for life. Because there's nothing more powerful than sitting there in the first session after someone has emptied their duffel bag, so to speak, and you say, well, let me see if I got this. You're telling me that ever since you were da-da-da-da-da, you have always felt that, and what you really have found is that no matter what you do, this is not getting better. And by the time you say it, they look at you, and they say, wow, you said in 2 minutes what it took me a whole session to say, and you're right on, you get it. Well, at that moment, the therapist has the trust of that person because once I get it, now I can help you.
Right, right. Absolutely. So that resonated deeply with me, and I was really happy to read that.
The second thing you said is that it's not enough to teach them to cope, that, hey, we got something better for you. We have healing. You can actually be done with this.
Right.
And when somebody's been through something horrible like a childhood where they've been sexually abused repeatedly or combat where there's a lot of ugly episodes that need to come out, or, you know, for one woman, she was from the time she was 4 years old, she was a victim of human trafficking and story after story of horrible things. But she had to pull every one of them out in order to heal. When Freud talked about you have to make the unconscious conscious, you have to bring out everything that's toxic inside of you. Therapy for people like this is difficult. It's painful. It can take years depending upon what's happened to them. But they can also learn to do things in a very short period of time because it's a simple formula that allows them to process whatever it is that's unfinished. And so I taught 5 steps. The first one is remember, you have to go back to whatever's unfinished. How do you know it's unfinished? Because it continues to haunt you. You have nightmares about it, or you have flashbacks, or you want to avoid any time it comes up. You want to avoid anything that reminds you of it. You still have anxiety about those things. You would do anything but talk about what happened while you were overseas in Afghanistan, or you blocked out all memory of your childhood. These are indications that if you want to heal, we have to go back. And so I have people write. Get a journal and just let the pen flow, or a lot of people do that on their personal computers today. But the point of it is, remember, you got to go back to what's unfinished. And then you have to feel the things that you've blocked out, which people don't want to do. My Vietnam vets, they don't want to sit down and cry about men that they watched die 50 years ago, but they have to. If we're going to finally finish this, we have to go back to what happened. You know, I have had people come in when there have been things in the news. For instance, at Penn State, few years back, there was something going on about the sexual abuse of young males. And their defensive coach was guilty of molesting males. Well, that prompted a physician to come in to talk to me about being molested one time by a traveling magician when he was in middle school. This was 50 years ago, but the man had never dealt with it. And we had a chance. You know, he had to remember, he had to feel, he had to tell me the story, express the story, and then he had to finally say goodbye to it. And by doing so, he was finally able to address his alcoholism, because his alcoholism for all these years was a way to cover over his feelings. He didn't have to deal with anything as long as he was inebriated.
And it becomes a domino effect in society, because when someone doesn't heal the pain of their past and then they have children, they're not prepared to raise their children with a healthy mindset. And then those children have, you know, say they become adult children of alcoholics. And then if they don't fix that, you know, then they raise their children with dysfunction. And so it's so important that when we have this pain, we nip it in the bud and end the legacy. Don't you believe that?
What an insightful comment you just made. It's exactly true, because whatever isn't finished with the parents, you know, it's kind of like passing the sins down to the next generation. It's like you're dysfunctional, so you're not going to raise the healthiest children, because they're not going to be allowed to process healthy emotions, because it's something that you won't allow them to do, and you're not comfortable doing them. Not to mention all the things that reside alongside of alcoholism or drug abuse or just being in such a dysfunctional mindset, because you're still broken by whatever the traumas were. And today we have new research. Part of it comes out of Connecticut after the shootings there. The researchers have had a chance to evaluate what goes on with people who've been traumatized. And to make a long story short, they realize that trauma is actually at the bottom of a lot of addiction. In fact, the former president of the American Psychiatric Association was quoted as saying, "Smoking is to cancer as trauma is to addiction." And so we not only see people who are devastated by trauma, but that it's a setup for them to become compulsively involved in some other kind of behavior, whether it's chemicals or, you know, compulsive gambling or compulsive video games or something that allows, that transports them to another feeling state, so they don't have to deal with the trauma. One study found that if children had six or more aversive events, you know, traumas that happened to them in their first 18 years, when compared to kids who didn't have any, that they were 144 times more likely to put a needle in their arm, you know, to get involved in heroin abuse, just because they've been traumatized.
Right. Exactly.
We have another study that said 2 out of 3 female alcoholics were molested as children. 2 out of 3. And so that's one of the questions I'll routinely ask a woman who's in the hospital. I consult at the local hospital, and she's in there for alcohol abuse. I'll ask her, so tell me a little bit about your childhood. Was there any molestation? And then I'll see the eyes light up with tears. And then I'll find out they didn't deal with this ever before, but they learned at an early age that if they started to drink and or drug, they didn't have to feel those feelings and deal with them.
It's so true. That is so true. I know that the DSM-5 doesn't recognize complex PTSD, but it is recognized by many. What is your feeling about that?
Well, it's a lot easier to help somebody who's had one bad car accident, and that's their trauma, than somebody who had a whole childhood full of, one traumatic story after another, after another, after another. And so the complex, which is when people were through many, many, or experienced many, many traumas, is a lot harder to treat. The first one, you know, can be over in one session. I've had a lot of those one session only. First, the session is about getting an intake. Second session is doing a guided imagery session to put away something ugly. And the third session, they're better. And that's great. That's all they need. I had such a gentleman years ago, and the fire chief called me up and said, "Man, we got a problem. We need you. There's a young man. His wife found him in the bathroom last night with a loaded gun in his mouth, and he said he can't take us anymore." So the man came in, and I found out that he had been getting training to become a police officer, and he was accidentally shot in the face with some wood chip blank. And so he wasn't badly hurt, and he wasn't badly scarred, but what happened was the trauma of that event would not stop repeating on him, and every night he'd have dream after dream taking him back to being shot in the face. And he finally said, "I will not do this every night." So I said, "We're going to finish that. This is a problem of closure. Your mind is repeating this because it needs to be finished." So I did a guided imagery with him where we went to the movies and we watched it one more time all the way through to the end. And I said, "You don't need this anymore. You can express your feelings about it, the fear and the horror." And we took the tape or the DVD from the movie and threw it out in the trash after watching it. And this man said he had a dream one more time that same night and then never again. And I saw him years later. He wanted to do marital therapy, and I asked him, "Whatever happened about the recurrent dreams?" He said, "Doc, you know, we finished that. That was done." And it took one session. So that's an example of something that could take one shot, finish it, remember, feel, express, release. And then we put a new frame on it, and you're good to go. If it's complex, meaning that you grew up in a devil-worshipping cult and you have memory after memory of terrible things that were done to you, you know, in the backwoods somewhere, well, it's going to take us longer because every one of these ugly stories need to resurface. They have to be told and felt and expressed. And, you know, we use up boxes and tissues, but we finish them. And that's the beauty of doing this job.
Yeah. So are you saying that you do believe that complex PTSD should be recognized as a disorder?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I've had an opportunity to treat a lot of people who were what we call today dissociative identity disorder, formerly known as multiple personality patients. And every one of them that I've treated had one thing in common. They were all sexually abused as girls, and severely so, not once, not twice, not a couple of times over a summer, but for years, sometimes many times by many different perpetrators. And the way they protected themselves from that is they not only disappeared from their body when it was happening, but they created other selves to take it for them. It was just a brilliant defense. You know, think about a big job to do by yourself, like maybe you live in a big home and you're going to move to another home. Moving day by yourself is impossible. So what do? You call everyone you've ever met to come over and you buy them pizza, and everybody helps you move all your stuff from one place to another. And that's what these people have done. They hired all these people to help them carry the impossible. But in therapy, amazingly enough, they tell one story that they had completely blocked out, one after another, until there are no more stories. They've completed it. And we could take the many people and put them back into one. This is going to sound incredible and ridiculous, but over the years, I have had 17 people who were multiple personalities who are now one person. We finished the job, and four of them were teachers, and two of them were nurses, and there were a lot of professional, high-functioning women who didn't even themselves know until later on. They thought it was normal to have all these voices in their head, and they thought other people lost time like they did. And some of them didn't want to be multiple because it was absolutely humiliating. The idea that someone could see them, like one woman was on the floor of Toys R Us for 3 hours. This was a woman in her early 60s, but she was in a child state playing on the floor with the toys. And she found out about that, she was humiliated. You know, wasn't, in other words, it wasn't anything feigned or faked. It was a real manifestation of what was going on because we were starting to uncover the horror of her abuse. But where she is today, she's one person, and she's happily married, and she has a chance at a good life finally after so many years of suffering through a hellacious childhood. So yeah,
it's
I have an exciting story to share.
I was going to say, it's so important for people to reach out for help. So many people are afraid to do that. They, for many reasons, I guess, but, you know, I always encourage people to reach out for help. You can't always do everything alone. Now, I know the premise of your book is that there are things that you can do to release it yourself. But I feel as if you can't, if you cannot
right.
release it yourself, then you must reach out because you don't have to suffer with this.
Absolutely. And some people don't have the money or the insurance to do ongoing therapy. And even just occasional visits where the therapist can kind of help guide them on what to be working on in between. That here's my fantasy for people. I tell them, I want you to have all of your energy in the here and now looking forward so that your entire past is finished. You could remember it. You could tell stories about it. You could laugh about it. You could say, boy, that was difficult. But you're not stuck back there. And if you can't tell me that that's true, and because you are stuck back, you have resentments, you have regrets, you have horrors and traumas you can't go anywhere near, things are still painful, you're still sad or guilty or hating your parents or whoever a perpetrator was, you're not finished. And that stuff needs to be dealt with, and it needs to come up one thing at a time until we can say goodbye to each one of the things and or people that are still tormenting you. If you look at biblical forgiveness, it's not about condoning the bad things that happened. It's about letting them go. And letting them go is not the first step. That's why you don't just tell someone on the first time they walk in, you have to forgive your father for molesting you. No, you first have to tell me everything that ever happened to you because you have to remember, feel, express, release. You know, we could say goodbye at that point to the perpetrator. And forgiveness does not mean reconciliation. That's one type of forgiveness. But there's another type of forgiveness that merely says, I'm letting go of what you did to me, but there's no room for you in my life.
Right. That's important. That's really important to know. So the five steps that you talk about in your book is are remember, feel, express, release, reframe. That's perfect. So logical. Do you find that some people are struggling so much just to reach ground zero that they need some medication to help ease that up so that they can do the work that they need to do? Or do you find that that's not necessary?
Okay, so medication can help people with symptoms. Medication doesn't cure this thing, but it can help people, for instance, have less anxiety. It can help people have a higher floor so they don't sink as low. It can help people sleep better so that they're not up all night. But what I like people to know is you're not doing medication instead of your treatment, and medication should not interfere with your treatment by helping you to feel good enough that you don't do the work that's necessary. So in the book, you may have seen there's an analogy that if I have kidney stones in my kidney and then one of them drops into the ureter, the only thing that matters in this world is getting that kidney stone out. Because when those, and I've had these, so I'm talking about my own personal experience. When these things are acute, there isn't anything in the world that matters but get this out of me. And they get stuck in there. And if you give me really good medication so that I don't feel the pain anymore, you might be giving me temporary relief, but the truth is I do need the stone out because it's going to be cutting up my ureter as it moves, and it's not a healthy place for it to stay. It will cause long-term damage if that stone is not released. So if you're going to give me some medication to knock me out because you're going in to remove the stone, that's fine. But the stone has to come out. I hope that analogy makes sense.
That's an excellent, and I did read that in the book, actually. So medication can be a companion to the psychotherapy.
There you go.
Right, okay.
It's okay. A good word. It's not in lieu of. It's alongside. It accompanies it.
Okay, great. So let me switch over a little bit to the physiology and the neuroplasticity of the brain and everything. And it's known, and you say this in your book, that trauma can quite literally change the brain. And when it does, it makes life more difficult to negotiate, to navigate. So how exactly does abuse or trauma change the brain?
You know, we don't know exactly. We know that the stress response does bad things to our entire body, including our brain, if it's left on. If Hans Selye wrote about the general adaptation syndrome, and he said there are three stages of the stress response. And the first one is fight or flight, the alarm reaction. And that's when you're driving down the road, say, and there's flashing lights in your rearview mirror. Almost 100% of us will begin the stress response. And then let's say we're pulled over and we're either given a ticket or not. Within minutes, we can shut off that stress response, essentially by processing our feelings and letting it go and saying, oh, well, I'll pay the ticket, I'll go to the driver improvement class, whatever it takes, and then we let it go. And we're built for that. We can have that happen in our lives. But then what happens so often is that stressors, whatever they are, they don't go away as quickly as that. For instance, a high-conflict marriage persists into a high-conflict divorce, or financial problems or being underemployed, they just continue. Or we have a child who's sick, but no one can correctly diagnose. These things, they continue to stress the body and the brain, and then they go into a second stage called resistance. So now we're still fighting in high gear. This was only supposed to be a short-term thing. Now we're in resistance, and we're fighting it for months or years, that the perceived stressor is continuous. And that leads to a third stage of exhaustion where things begin to break down. You know, we see changes that occur in the brain and the prefrontal cortex. We see things like lower back pain. We see things like diabetes. You know, people can sometimes have TIAs or full-blown strokes. You know, we go again from alarm reaction to resistance to exhaustion where there's a breakdown. And then the logical sequence is to disease and to death. You know, stress response kept on over time is what ages the body and also what takes us to a premature death. And trauma is exactly that. It turns on the stress response, but it doesn't shut off because we've never finished the trauma. We have to tell the story. You know, even those who are in recovery, you know, you do the 12 steps. The fourth and fifth steps are about expressing all the kinds of things that I did to hurt people, and I'm taking complete ownership in the fourth step. But in the fifth step, I have to tell somebody. I have to express. I have to read it. I have to get it out of me. Because you know what they say in the rooms? You're only as sick as your secrets. And that's so true. If you want to stop drinking, sometimes we have to get to the secrets, the terrible stuff that I've been harboring for years, because these are the things that make me need to drink or drug, because I can't come face to face with the horror of what happened.
Right. And so, and false guilt comes into play, because I think everyone who's had trauma has a certain amount of false guilt. And the self-blame is something that keeps people stuck in this loop of self-punishment. So how do you help people with false guilt?
There's a story in the book that I particularly enjoyed telling because I love this guy. He came in with his wife one time when his son overdosed to death on drugs, and his physician referred them to say, go get some help. And they never came back again until 2 years later. He came in by himself and he said, Doc, I can't seem to get past the guilt. And I said, tell me about your guilt. And he said, every day I feel bad that my son died. I should have stopped it. I should have done something to prevent him from dying from drug abuse. And I said, tell me what you did. And he said, that's just it. I tried everything. I put him in rehab a couple of times. I'm not sure if I'm still on. Am I still on?
Yes, I'm listening. Yes. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello? You are still on. I don't know what happened. Are you there? Oh, gosh. Okay. Well, that's a shame. I hope we didn't lose him, because this is such a fascinating, important guest, and I really do, I would love to have him back. So if you are interested in hearing more of what Dr. Kortman has to say, just email me at loveyourlife@randygfine.com, and you can send me some questions. And when I accumulate some questions, I will have Dr. Kortman back on to talk about this, because he is so in sync with how I feel. And, okay, yes, we lost him. Okay. I really like what he has to say in his book. So pick up a copy of Keep Pain in the Past, Getting Over Trauma, Grief, and the Worst Thing That's Ever Happened to You. And I think that you will find some very beneficial things in here. But, but if you've listened to me and you know my philosophy on healing and validation and all those things, it really is an honor to have him, again, validate what I've been feeling and using and saying. So I'm going to have Dr. Kortman back. I don't know what happened. But anyway, it's been really wonderful. Thank you for listening in. Next week, on the 12th, okay, my next show is going to be on April 12th, and that is the day that I do my show where I take your calls and answer your questions. So you can either call in live at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. The show runs for 45 minutes. Call in a little bit early before 11 so you get in. And you can ask me whatever question you want to ask me, and I will be happy to answer. If you can't call in live, you can email me at loveyourlife@randygfine.com with your question, and I will read it on the air. So I look forward to a show with lots of input. Please you know, participate in the show because it really helps other people. And that's about all I have for you today. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randi Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randigfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randi G. Fine.